Hello, everyone. Welcome to Tech. No, wait, wrong thing. I mean,
is it gone? We have a guest today.
I think this is amazing starting. Like, literally, I will cut literally exactly that.
All right. Well, welcome to the Non-Intuitive Bits. I'm your host, Zane Rizvi, and we have a really good show lined up today. So first, one of my we've got the two normal co-hosts. We have Slava.
Slava, wake up.
Slava, would you like to say
something? You're expecting me to say something? Sure. Yeah. Yes. Hi, my name is Slava. You probably know who I am, but nevertheless, welcome back.
And Sandeep.
Hey, guys. Nice to be talking to you. Looking forward to talking to some other special person as well. Same.
Yes, and we have a special guest today, all the way from Amazon. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, hello everyone. I am Chaitanya, but you can call me Chai. I am from Amazon, but specifically work on MXNet. And I stay in Santa Clara, and right now sitting cozy for 5 p.m. And yeah, happy.
All right, nice. So yes, we are at week 4 or 5. I'm losing track now. I should have a marker of the stay-at-home, staycation. And now I think, like, as we're the staycation is going on, more and more people are getting excited to join the podcast because people have nothing else to do.
Well, yeah, that was not the reason, but I mean, yeah, you can say so.
Like I said, I read on Twitter, someone had said at this point of time, startups should also be more offensive, not just defensive, because this period is going away and you need to have your offensive plans on building new features. Don't be too conservative. So, and utilize this time to kind of grab and do things wildly. So we are utilizing this time to increase our guest podcast list.
That's true. And if anybody is interested in being a guest on the show, reach out to either of us and we can set something up. It's great to get more perspectives on the show.
On that note, also, we have a Slack. We have a Slack, and I don't think we have three users in our Slack. to be fair, I think we should declare this initiative as failed one and decide about different chatting message for inviting visitors. Just to compare, I'm using Telegram on another initiative, and it has like already 40 people, just because Telegram provides one click sign in. I believe that is the reason. Like, I just putting link with Slack. I think the biggest problem that we need to invite people, so we need them to do something. They cannot just click and then sign in. That's my guess. But nevertheless, we do have Slack. If you ping us, we will invite you. Also,
to be fair, there's probably like some psychological thing where if you're telling someone, hey, join our community, there's no one there, no one to join.
But we hide the fact that no one there till today. I don't think it's going to change much. But
I think we are not promoting the Slack channel or all the communication channel we have in each and every episode. For example, we might have burst more listeners who might have listened to only, say, this episode and came to our page for this episode. And the Slack channel we put across probably 10 episodes ago. So even though we are saying, join our Slack channel, we are not providing a one-click link in the same page where they're listening from. So probably there is something that we could do. Let's figure it out.
That's true. And even like podcasts kind of have this thing where if you're on a website, it's very easy to just immediately click the link. Like you said, oh, there's a channel. Let me click the link and join it right away. With a podcast, you're not even on your computer most of the time. You're doing something else. You're driving or something. And then you have to remember, oh, hey, I have to go there, click the link. So maybe like posting about it on Twitter or something might be a better place to let people know about the Slack channel.
Show notes. Just put the link in show notes at the end, because once in a while the people do look on show notes, and if the link there, they might click. The biggest problem here is that for Slack, we can only provide link for self-requesting invite. And even that, we need to actually do a work to have a service that allows to automatically request an invite to Slack. Otherwise, we don't even have anything on which you can click.
Chai, yeah, our guest, true. What do you think? What could bring you to our Slack channel?
I feel to get the community engaged, there needs to be some sort of way of getting feedback from them. Might be the topics that you covered, maybe ask a few tidbits or questions regarding that, or like basically something only. So there's one factor which will pull people towards communication is if they have something to talk about, and that can be that can be one way you could pull people in.
So all you listeners, do you agree with this suggestion?
Yes. Now I'm saying that, but so if I was a listener, I would say yes. And then
right back and let us know.
What should I do now? I said yes, but what should I do now? That is the exact problem with Slava is saying now.
And by the way, from now on, you cannot come second time to our podcast if you're not a part of the Slack. Like that's it.
Cool. I'm downloading it.
Oh, and in case anybody thinks they might remember this, the Slack channel is thenonintuitivebits.slack.com. We have to at least say what the channel is if we're going to talk about it.
We need self-requesting invite, because if you go to that, you cannot like register. It's a Slack.
It doesn't even like give you the option to log in?
No, because Slack by default is for targeting private groups. So they don't even have such notion. I create a public group. So you need to deploy a small service that automatically sends invites. It's a simple process because many groups around Slack using it as open group. So they're effectively deploying somewhere a more or less static page where you can provide email, click one button, invite me, and you will get invitation to that Slack. But you cannot log in because by default Slack assumes that this is a private group. This is their main audience. They don't care about such use cases as public Slack. So they don't support it. That's why I'm saying we don't even have a link. If you go to that link, it will ask you login password and that's it.
That makes sense. You know what? Maybe we should just forget about Slack and move to Telegram.
Yeah, that would be much, much simpler. Yes.
Telegram is just like really simple to get in, and you have just one channel effectively. That's the thing Slack gives you, all the different channels, but you don't need a channel for most groups. In fact, I think all the groups that I've joined on Slack, I almost never go to them because Slack is a bit of a pain to switch between different groups.
Exactly, yes. This is another problem. Even if you invite it, you have to go through all this hell circles. Yeah.
But how can we forget the integrations that Slack has? And I know the stock of Slack has shot down, like it has nosedived, but there are so many tons of integrations and plugins that you can use Slack with that it is power-packed in that.
Yeah, those integrations are great if you're trying to do stuff and get something done. But if you're just trying to have like a conversation with other folks, I don't know if those integrations provide much value.
Right, yeah. For minimalistic purposes, yeah, we don't need Slack. Yeah.
And this is what happens when you're not the target customer.
It goes to our boss theory, user-oriented development program. And our user care about sending a message. And I do not care about a Salesforce integration to my Slack channel. So I do not care. So let's see what helps me to type a message, read a message. That is what our user-oriented development program, how would I call him? Master Chef would say that. So that is your feedback, Chaitanya.
Yeah.
Am I right, Master?
Of course. And by the way, you want to learn more, uodp.club. And I think we need to bootstrap a religion around this. Okay.
So now I think it's a good time to move on to more COVID stuff. So in the news today, Apple and Google are launching a joint COVID-19 tracing tool for iOS and Android. And basically what this tool is meant to do is it's supposed to be using Bluetooth to keep your phone and like keep track of all the people you've been around for the past 2 weeks. And as you, if someone finds out that they're infected, it'll let all the other people that you've been around also know that, hey, you've been in contact with somebody who was infected with COVID-19. You might want to get yourself checked as well.
Pretty cool.
Interesting.
So this is a interesting thing where you only have like Apple and Google are the only ones who can really do something like this, because you need this baked in at pretty much the OS level to make it working at scale. But then there's a lot of privacy implications that this has.
They technically call it as contact tracing, right? In COVID.
Yes.
Yeah. I was actually reading about that back in with respect to India. So where the population is so dense, and to be very fair, I was having same chat with another person in my team back in work. Like how is it even possible for someone to do a contact tracing in so densely populated country like India, even say New York? How do you even know? I think this solution is very innovative. I mean, I understand the privacy concerns that you're bringing up, but with respect to innovation and its effectiveness in doing the contact tracing in absolutely close to 100% accuracy, I think this is amazing.
On those lines, last weekend, I spent some time scraping data off Google's mobility report 2020 or 2019, where basically they released for every country, they showed percentage decrease in mobility towards grocery shopping, mobility towards like public parks, and like 7-8 different things. And they are trying to track, they're using the Google Map data to show how much impact mobility has had because of COVID-19. So yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of innovation happening over there.
So it's maybe just going to get your groceries and back home in India might not mean you've been in contact with 1,000 people.
By the way, back in Ukraine, we just introduced e-passport, electronic passport, I think, or something like that. We already have a driver license that you can show on your phone, so it's effectively embedded in some kind of the app. And I've heard recently that they introduced ability to self-disclose your location to the government, so they can effectively track some of your movement specifically for this use case. But you need to implicitly allow them. This is at least what I've heard, and I don't know if it's even true or not to a certain extent, but yes, paranoid people and paranoid in me are kind of worried about all these movements.
By the way,
and who knows, maybe the controversy, the fake part about that thing might be that it's opt-in.
First of all, yes, the government, you know, they will request your geographical location just because they don't know how to write another type of app, even though they will not want the story. They just
go ahead.
I wanted to recall, Zane, you remember how they implemented this app for counting votes? So, like, I wouldn't be surprised if it would tracing geographic location just by mistake.
So, how do we know that a person has COVID? So, is this based on self-reporting, or is it based on, like, government enforces via hospitals to do the self-reporting?
They've got a bit of an interesting setup, which is, like, in theory, it actually sounds kind of cool. So it's got two levels. One is just like how you're tracking the contact tracing. And then I think the part you're asking about is how they know they're infected, which is basically there's like some government is going to be providing certain apps which integrate with this tool. And so when they realize that they're positive, it's more of a proactive thing, at least right now. And like in phase one would be like some proactive thing where it says, oh, hey, look, I was infected, so please let everyone else know. You can imagine the government might later on be more proactive and say, okay, hey, look, you were infected, please give us your phone so we can mark this person, like your ID, as being infected, and everyone else can find out. Or you maybe just give them your phone at the point of taking the test. So your identification has kind of been given out before you even know if you were tested positive or not. So those are like not quite like clear yet, because that's just like it's an API. This hasn't been developed yet. It's an API that's, I think, either just been given or is going to be given to government entities to actually develop into an app. But the way they're doing the contact tracing in an anonymous way was pretty cool, because what they're doing is that every few minutes, like every 10-15 minutes, your phone is generating a new ID, and it'll be looking for any of the other Bluetooth phones with that same package or API installed on it. And it'll just be kind of transmitting its own ID to the other phones and receiving the other phone's ID and just storing that on the phone. So there's no location-based information that's being tracked. You're just getting a list of all the people who you've been in contact with and the timestamp at which you were in contact with them. You could theoretically be keeping track of where you were at that point in time, so you kind of know where the other numbers were. But since everybody's number keeps changing to a new completely random number every 10-15 minutes, it's hard to track an individual that way. And then once, like what your phone will keep doing is just on a regular basis, it'll just keep going to the website and say, hey, look, who are the people who have, what are the IDs that are reported as having had this disease? Or actually, when you report yourself as having had COVID-19, your phone will upload all the information it's had, or all the IDs it's used in the past 2 weeks. And then everybody else will just constantly be checking the database of IDs that have said they've had COVID-19 and downloading it and checking it against their own IDs of people they've been in contact with.
Yeah, it's like DMV maintaining your car registration and your details and then notifying you when there is a recall.
Kind of.
And perfect application of a distributed system where slave is actually letting the master know frequently in a specific timestamp that I am alive. And then the master knows who are all the slave connected to it, and it communicates if it wants anything to be communicated.
Right. I mean, this system does have certain weak points where it could give away some people's privacy, like specifically like the person who is infected who uploads all their numbers at once effectively. And so you can kind of realize, oh, hey, this was all that same person. But that's a little more restricted about how much, again, it's giving away less than how other approaches might give up.
Also, just curious, is there any verification done to like on like when I say that I've been diagnosed with COVID-19, like who tests that? What sort of mechanism is
it? That's not quite clear yet. So it would be done through an app that the government provides, and then like the. You can trust governments to be competent, right? To have a secure way to have this done.
It's funny you are laughing. But yeah, we can assume for this purpose that yeah.
Yeah, there's some answer needs to be figured out for that for sure.
Yeah.
But that's a pretty cool thing. Like, who came up? Is it like government came up, or is it like a collaboration of companies like Google and Apple engineers who came up with this proposal? Like, do you have any details about that?
This is specifically Google and Apple engineers that have been working on this. And I think they've been working on this for the past 2 weeks or so. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they started working on this a couple weeks ago, and now they officially announced it today. Mm-hmm.
I actually realized that I should have learned. So yeah, we do have several initiatives that actually resulted in things like that. But I realized that I don't know what I can, what I cannot speak. So
yeah,
I might try to in the background to find answer for myself and maybe have some other interesting things to share.
That can be shared.
You know, it's nice to see Google and Apple on this list. But you think, like, hey, why isn't Microsoft on this list?
I think Microsoft is pushing boundaries from Azure perspective. Same with AWS as well.
But they don't want an app for Windows Mobile?
I think people who are using Windows Mobile would be in forest or in a very remote place. not be affected by COVID. So it's a like user-oriented development programming, yes, sir. It has affected your user base. Don't waste time building for it. Just because you want to build it, don't build it. If there is a user, build it.
Yeah.
And you're becoming a very strong advocate of the user-oriented development programming practice.
More than advocate, you could call follow of our UODP.club Osho.
Yeah. What was that last word? Osho?
Yeah, the guru, or you could call the spiritual guru of the this movement.
Okay.
As soon as this situation is over, we definitely will have to bootstrap with a meetup or something.
Yeah, the one which we are talking, right? I think it will be very, very important. A very close group of people, and it will be really fun.
So, dear listeners, you will not be able to participate, because we were indeed was speaking about bootstrapping some interesting small invite-only gatherings to discuss different topics for different... By the way,
Everyone on our podcast group will probably be invited.
Everyone from Slack, yes. Everyone who on the Slack,
for sure.
Listeners,
if you are in and around Bay Area, for sure, you will be welcomed. On invite.
Yes. We will not disclose time and location, but overall, yes, feel free to come. Now, to that extent, I just realized that there is not so many gatherings, meetups, conference talks about eng leadership. Like, for engineering, each day I can go to a meetup for specifically something about how to deliver successful product. Nothing, literally almost nothing. Either super high end from the perspective of price tag courses, that usually if you Google for who organizing them, the only things that person made successful is the course, or nothing. And I surprised, like, why? It feels like if you would have a meetup about eng leadership, there should be many who would be interesting. Nevertheless, nothing, like almost nothing, even in Bay Area. I don't know if the same situation in Washington State or out of Seattle, but...
Are the people who become successful too busy being successful to host a conference?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
It's a secret sauce that they don't want to share.
On that aspect, to put more... details. Probably, Zain, we are going to take another couple of minutes. Slava is getting free advertisement on his UODP.club, and I will also try to take some more free advertisement chip on some other things me and Slava were discussing. So we were thinking of two things. One, which Slava already talked about, a meetup group where we could have people share about things, ask about things, and then it's basically bringing people together in a single room, maybe in a coffee shop, and then that without agenda. I mean, we could have agenda, but without agenda, a group of smart people interested in similar things for sure is going to create something new, and sharing the learnings and various aspects on that. You could also call it as mentorship group, and Slava can be mentor on one topic for me, I could be for him on another, but it's basically we being together in that meetup group is what matters at the end of the day. That's one thing. Second thing, which I was actually planning to talk to Slava just this evening, was that I wanted to start a podcast around engineering leadership, with partnership from Slava again. On discussing with engineering leaders, when I say engineering leaders, it could be managers, it could be TLMs and various people, TLM, tech lead managers, and then discuss their motivation, some of the challenges, how they think. So for a listener, it should break down the thinking of such people. And if you interview, say, 10 to 15 people, you will be able to clearly disseminate different styles of leadership. Nothing is better than other, but it's basically like within 15 to 20 hours, you are going to listen the real experience of people doing that job and their perspective and why. So the idea was also like, let's start with early in their career in leadership. Say for me and Slava, it's new. And there will be a lot of people in our similar boat, just a small delta before or after in their career path similar to us, right? That is phase one. And let's assume once we are done with that, I wanted to go and do a season two where they're a bit of more senior and experienced inch managers. And once you do, say, 15-20 episodes of that, season three would be like at VP, director, and much more C-suit level. Like they have higher troubles and problems and fires to put off, and then higher way of looking at things in more broader perspective. So if you do it at much multiple layers of seasons, maybe 3 to 4 seasons, you will be able to clearly disseminate the differences of thinking, the type of problems each people face at different level. Gives you opportunity if you are at level 1 engineer manager, and then how level 3 people are thinking now, it prepares you to get in that shoes. I was reading a very interesting book which again Slava suggested, was Rise. That is a really, really cool book. I think me and Zain already had a session, episode just discussing about that book.
And that book was amazing.
Yeah. In that book, one thing I really liked is nothing comes to you now. You should always assume and have a picture and get into that shoes and start acting or working like that. And then you will be there. It doesn't matter about the title. Eventually, you will be there. And this kind of podcast thing we were thinking was basically getting you into that mode of getting into that shoes, thinking in that direction, and being able to, like, say, ask a question, say Slava answers something from his perspective, and you are, like, say, let's assume 2 years behind where you will be in Slava's position in 2 years. Can you answer that question and see how the thinking of you and the person already dealing that problems differ, or how can you be there? So we were thinking of doing a podcast on that idea.
That's a pretty cool idea. It sounds a lot like some of the really cool stuff that I've followed over the years, which are just someone starting from nothing. Either they're building a new project from nothing, or they're starting a company from zero, and they're kind of documenting their journey as they go along. And so this sounds like it's kind of that kind of a pattern. And those tend to be really cool stories because you just get to see exactly what's happening, and you're not, the stories are not biased as much by the hindsight that, like, your memories get hazy and you kind of forget what actually happened, and you have a much more rosy picture of what was going on. So
yeah, so listeners, please stay tuned. We will come up with a podcast soon, very soon. May not be even more than 10 days from now with first episode.
Whoa, that is soon. That is actually very concrete and very soon indeed. That is surprising.
Anyways, let's get back to Zane's show, Slava. I think we took away.
It's all good. This was really cool to hear, so anything interesting is good. So next topic on our regularly scheduled program is this article about Python. Why Python is not the programming language of the future.
Oh man, I shot this article. I forgot to read it.
Yeah. Okay, well, in that case, I guess I will summarize the article.
That was good.
Yeah, yes.
I shared it for you, students. Your students, you have to read it. I will give you the exam and make the correction, learn as I do the corrections.
And I really like this article just because of the title, which is that it's trying to predict the future, which is something Slava hates. And yet Slava recommended this article.
I need something to hate in this podcast. That sounded exactly that type of articles.
So I'll do a quick summary of the pros and cons of Python's the article lists. It says, one, it's the pros are that it's old, it's been around, it's grown, and has a lot of community that's built around it. It's friendly for beginners. You can read it and learn it fairly quickly. And there's a lot of different packages that have been built for it. So it has a strong network of packages that can let you do various different things, like data science, AI, and whatnot. The downsides, according to the article, Python is really slow. There's some weird stuff with scoping going on, some weird stuff with lambdas, which didn't seem like that big of a deal to me. Some stuff with white spacing. The guy is annoyed with white spacing for some reason. Downsides are kind of weird in the article. This is on towardsdatascience.com. And then mobile development, Python isn't that great, which is true. Runtime errors, Python is harder to debug. And those are basically the pros and cons. So the guy is basically saying, hey, at some point in the future, Python will be replaced. Because it has some pros, it has some cons, so something else will come up which fix the cons.
One quick question. When someone is saying it's not for future, how long is the future definition? Is it like in next 10 years it will not be there, next 5 years it wouldn't be there, or like is it like next 50 years? But eventually everything will go away, so still he's right. Python will go away.
That is,
if you take a span of 50 years or 100 years, yeah, for sure it will go away. But like, what exactly is the future that he is referring to?
That was exactly my thoughts when I was reading this article. 100% what you're saying, because like, and he says like, yeah, you can't put an exact expiration date on this thing, so it'll happen at some point in the future.
You know, in the Russian speaking community, we have this dude, Murtazin. He's analytics about mobile platform, and he literally saying message, not exactly this word, that the Apple would die and no one buying iPhones, and he doing this since iPhone 4S. And he actually got famous when he was saying that Nokia going to die. No one believed him. Nokia have died. And starting iPhone 4S, he starts predicting that Apple will die, because like Android will completely kill them. I still remember listening that podcast when he was, iPhone 4. Because when 4S came out, it's exactly after Steve Jobs have passed, unfortunately. And he was saying, I don't know why people still buying 4S. It's probably some magic 4S, like almost like it says for Steve, so they can be buying. And each next release of the iPhone, he would publish it. And he's super popular. He actually owns the most popular review portal on Russian language. So he has a huge business. He effectively owns the company that now owns that portal. So he can predict any bullshit he wants. He's not going to lose any income. But nevertheless, it's so funny to read him. Each time, each new iPhone, like Apple is dead, they're dying. And eventually he will be right. I'm pretty sure like X amount of years from now, he will tell, I told you folks, I told you.
I've been saying this for the past 30 years.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
But yeah, on the Python side, Chaitanya, our guest, what do you think? Do you like Python? What do you think about Python's future?
I think the only thing scary about Python is the name Python. Everything else is simple. Like, even my grandmom, if I were to teach her, hey, this is how you create a list, she would be able to do that, right? So as long as people use data science, as long as people use data analytics, as long as there are people who don't know like technology that much but still want to dabble into it, Python is going to be their go-to tool, right? Like, I mean, it's so simple. So I beg to differ. Like, I feel it's going to be there for a long time. Of course, there are disadvantages, and every language has some. But I mean, there can be a new language for mobile development, but you don't need to crush Python for creating something new, right? They can coexist. C, C++, Python coexist. Java coexists. Java isn't going anywhere, so
yeah. That is true. By the way, I think this author I'm the victim. I've been victimized. It looks like I just clicked on clickbait article. I just look on the articles from the author, which looks like author publishes once per, he or she publishes once per week. Just random titles. 4 reasons why everyone except computer scientists write sloppy code. What terminal colors revealed about your personality? 9 reasons why you will never become a data scientist. 7 lessons that every business leader needs to learn from yada yada. 7 reasons why programmers burn out. 11 best... You get the idea.
learn data to get in 60 minutes is something most commonly
yes, exactly.
in our field. And if that is
that
is the case,
SQL
it would be so demotivating. And actually, more than the word demotivating, I would like to be more stronger, saying more depressing, when someone has spent 10 years in learning things and then probably has one like game-changing invention in 10 years. And others will come and say, hey, I can teach you deep learning in 60 minutes. And then you will be all deep learning scientist after that. So it would be so depressing for the 10 years. But the person
imposter syndrome kicks off into overdrive.
Yeah. I read a tweet yesterday. Someone was having a sarcastic tweet. I think now the ML versus DL is going on. Everyone is saying the future of AI is just deep learning, without having a knowledge about the basics of ML, that is still the majority. It's nothing like differentiating ML and deep learning. So other person was tweeting, yeah, for sure, I just started my PhD with deep learning, I think I need to quit. And then I need to follow this Osho of deep learning so he could teach me in 60 minutes how to do it, and then use remaining 499 days and then 23 hours for something else.
By the way, about this quickly learn something, have either of us watched Fast AI course?
I have.
I really like how it's starting. It's starting precisely from the principles where we can take something very simple and do it right now. Like, just to put in perspective, within two first hours, even if you have not caught the Python, in two first hours, you will implement fully workable, trained classifier of dog and cat breeds that works much better than white paper that published originally the results like 4 years ago, I think, or 5 years ago. Pretty cool. I actually like such type of learning, when you're starting with quick hacks how to do things and then slowly learning how it actually works and why it works.
So out of curiosity, the solution that they offer, how curated or how like prepared does the sample data need to be to work? Like, would it work with you just taking a picture of your dog and feeding it through that algorithm instantly, or does it have to be formatted in certain ways and like
pre-processed? Oh, Fast AI is amazing. You can take almost any picture. Like, just to give you perspective, I took random pictures of two fighters, F-22, F-35, which are pretty close together, and I took it from Google Pictures and created a neural network that's capable of distinguish one from two. And the actual key idea that they pre-processing photos for you, so they're doing cropping, they're doing many things for you automatically, so you don't have to bother about this. But the second biggest idea that's behind Fast AI, they have a very powerful SDK to allure pre-trained model and then do training of the last several layers on your data set. So effectively, when you're using Fast AI, you can say, give me pre-trained ImageNet with the best possible result with the architecture ResNet 50 or ResNet 101 or ResNet 150. And it downloads pre-trained graph with the best possible weights already, so it knows ImageNet, and now you're only training it on your photos, and they automatically will crop the photos. They're doing pre-processing on your photos. They not only can do cropping of your photo, they on your behalf will train it by flipping your photo, changing lighting for your photo, just to make sure that they can extract as many possible subversions of your photo as can be. And you time to time can say, don't flip it horizontally, don't flip it vertically if you want. Like, for example, if you're training dogs, you can say, I don't want my photo to be flipped vertically because I never took photos upside down. But yes, you don't need even to know how to prepare your photos.
Wow, that, and so that the transfer learning, all that stuff just happens kind of under the hood without you even having to choose to do anything. It's kind of automatic default stuff in the API.
Yep.
That's really cool.
And obviously, as you progress, it's like a magic box, black box. Jeremy starts to unpack it. He slowly shows you, here is what we're actually doing. Here is what we're actually doing here. Here is what actually happens here. But it's literally after several two lessons, you would be able to take your data set, completely train it on arbitrary photos, and deploy it to inference in production to several cloud servers, which is like amazing.
Yeah, it's sounding like I think what you just said was that after just the first couple lessons, you can deploy something practical and like that you created on your own. You're not just like having to play with their own data sets that they've offered you and modify their data sets. You actually can take your own stuff and build something that you can use in the real world. That is extremely rare out of all the AI courses that I've seen.
Exactly, yes. So if you like it, go to course.fastai.io or AI. And by the way, if you happen to be a GCP customer, we have fully pre-baked course already pre-installed. You can just open and use it and run it with zero friction.
On AWS as well, it comes pre-baked with deep learning AMI.
On SageMaker as well or AMI? AMI, I see, I see.
See, you are cutting down my advertisement so short. You said, I see, and you're changing, trying to change the topic. But
wait, I asked a follow-up question. I asked follow-up question about SageMaker.
What is SageMaker, sir?
You see?
Yeah, but yeah, I also attended a couple of classes. Not couple of classes, I think around 8 classes by Jeremy, where he was teaching Swift for TensorFlow along with Chris Lattner. So that was pretty amazing experience. It's pretty hands-on. The biggest strength, like you said, is understanding what is the most common things 80% of my users will be doing, and then try to make it so dumb that nobody has to rewrite or redo or rethink anything. Just make it out of the box. And for remaining 20% of the people, it doesn't apply or they don't care, fine. But you already captured 80% of your users by doing that as a default out of the box. And you actually gave away that much amount of time for your 80% of customers to think about other problems. So that is the biggest benefit. It's not just about usability. If I can get a one-liner to do all of these things, it actually gave me 4 hours. In that 4 hours, I would complete another class, which means it has snowball effect. I think all the open source and any product development needs to think about that. You're not just making it easy. You are actually in a position where the users will spend more time with your product now because they got away free time because of your good work in usability.
Just curious, you mentioned TensorFlow for Swift, right? What sort of, in terms of numbers, apart from, I know iOS apps are developed using, like previously used to use Objective-C, now they use Swift, but apart from that, what, how many people use Swift, or what is it used generally for, and why, like why was this targeted?
Swift is a programming language. It was built specifically for iOS, and it's the successor of Objective-C, and a new tool chain with LLVM and all the compiler complete end-to-end setup was built with Swift in the mind, and it took away a lot of good ideas from C, good ideas from C++ and also Java. And also including, like, when I say Java, it's about memory management and all other benefits you get out of this high-level abstractive language. And initially it was targeted for building iOS-based apps, both desktop as well as mobile. And the biggest strength of that language is the LLVM compiler and its toolchain. And it's closer to metal and very diversified and very optimized for different hardware, specific hardware chips, and a very close collaboration with this hardware manufacturer. So that is the strength of LLVM, which is actually translated to for people developing apps on Swift. So there, basically, how big is that? That's huge. Almost all iOS and apps are built with Swift. So, and Apple wants everyone to build these things with Swift. So it's huge with respect to usability, it's huge with respect to performance. And Swift for TensorFlow is a early work, but it's far ahead from where it was 2 years ago. When I say early, it's comparing with Python's user base. So it's not early with respect to the technology itself. It's early with respect to user base comparing to Python user base. And the biggest forward-looking idea, which I actually buy in, is that since it is closely related to the compiler, it is going to have the benefit of being native, like AutoGrad being native at the compiler level. Once you make this kind of operation at the compiler level, it is generally applicable optimizations that's going to happen across hardware platforms, right? Why Python was built? Earlier, deep learning was all built with C++ libraries. Python is a way to represent a graph, and it's kind of like a UI, for example. That's how it all started. Python was like a UI for deep learning and other core machine learning operations. In Python, all you are doing is basically, instead of a UI-based graph creation, you just write a bunch of Python code for that graph creation. Other than that, it's doing nothing. And that graph is taken by the C++ backend, and then everything is done at that level, right? So there is an indirection happening here, and a lot of restrictions apply. That is why Python, people say that it's slow, not performant, and other things in deep learning. It's because Python was built just as a front end to represent a graph. It's not built to solve a problem, and everything else was taken back end. Now Swift is getting away with that. So which means now we are opening up a whole new world of solving problem in native way, not have the translations, restrictions of cross language and various things. So it's really big outside deep learning. I think it's in top 5 or top 10 popular languages, if you see the Stack Overflow's yearly survey that happens. And with respect to machine learning, it's early with respect to user acquisition, but with respect to technology, it is really making a good progress. And
it's kind of interesting that by having Swift have like support for this heavy number crunching, which is, if I understand you correctly, this is what you're saying, it's basically supporting deep learning type of the number crunching intensity. So it's and Apple's encouraging developers to use this for that. So then Apple's effectively gaining an advantage for a market share in the phone industry, because it'll lead to developing apps that are just, that can do machine learning way better on iPhones than on Androids.
Yeah, there are libraries Apple is building, like CoreML, TuriCreate, and various things which they are making already easy to deploy deep learning, machine learning models on Apple phones. And I think at this point of time, only sophisticated users are able to do that, because they need to manage the memory, battery usage, and various complexities around that. It is still a lot of rough edges, but Apple is all set to gain from the next wave of using deep learning, machine learning models, like in almost all apps. So these are all like preparations that's happening, and I think it's going to be aligning all well in a couple of years from now. Everything is going to fall into single bucket.
Yeah, it's interesting. Even like Google has its own machine learning SDKs for Android phones that it offers. Now from like the developer's perspective, they're going to be saying, hey, how can I train a model that'll run on both of these two very different platforms?
Yeah, if you use Swift, Apple is gaining. I think Swift for TensorFlow is also becoming more closer to TPUs and specific hardwares that Google is building. And for mobile, I do not have like the story for Android with Swift. I at this point of time, Swift apps are not built for Android. So
I think Swift doesn't exist at this point outside of iOS ecosystem, like anywhere.
So with respect to Android mobiles, I don't know how this story is leading to and what Google might be thinking with respect to Android when they started Swift for TensorFlow. But I sure know, since they got it more closer to compilers and closer to metal optimization techniques with a native language, and asking users to build models, deploy models using that language, which is Swift, they have an advantage around TPU and other custom chips that will be built. So for sure, they are going to utilize Swift for TensorFlow efforts in their custom hardwares, but I don't know and I don't have a thought process around how this would help or impact Android deep learning applications going forward.
So what would TensorFlow look like in Swift? Because if my understanding was that TensorFlow is like a Python package and it's very tightly coupled to Python. So how would it look with your, what would it mean to have it for a different language? It's not the same code anymore.
So that's a very interesting topic. I think probably we need to spend an episode on that. At very high level, before it goes to compiler, there is something called as intermediate representation, or they call it as IR. Commonly in this domain. So once you get it into IR, all the compilers and hardware specific optimizers and various other tool chain that you build will all be like applicable across, because IR is a common representation like JVM code. And earlier it was basically like you had written your code in Python, like I said, at very, very abstract level of definition, you could say in deep learning frameworks, Python is just like a UI where you drag and drop and build your graph. And everything that's happening is after that. So that is taken back by a C++ backend engine that represents this IR and gives away to the compiler toolchain to actually run that graph in an optimized way, which compiler does optimize for everything. Now,
and this IR is something that is custom built by the TensorFlow team.
Yeah, it's called as MLIR. Okay. It's called ML,
gotcha.
Intermediate representation. And now it's also trying to push, can we have common IR across frameworks like PyTorch by Facebook, and there's TensorFlow by Google, MXNet by AWS, and there is also kind of like efforts to treat MLIR as a common representation across, so that under the hood, all the toolchain like LLVM compiler, they are making changes in LLVM compiler to be able to run these deep learning workloads well, right? So the compiler should be aware of the operations of deep learning. So it's like, can all of us contribute to LLVM compiler and use our own toolkits to come with a common IR? You can use Python, I could use Swift, someone else could use something else, but at the end, the toolchain is same, starting with that IR, then we will still be able to gain and develop in collaboration with each other. So that's one of the direction things are evolving.
By the way, I really like that direction by itself. If I don't know if you want to know, if you folks interested, I would suggest to at least read about two main, I would say, winners of this direction. One, obviously, TensorFlow IR, intermediary representation that TF has. Another one is TVM, right?
Yeah.
Sandeep, I correct? TVM, that's, yes. Yeah. So I think IR probably way more popular just because framework way more popular, but I don't think there is any other existing intermediary representation except these two virtual machines and technologies, yeah. TVM and IR for TF.
PyTorch and MXNet,
who's making TVM?
Towards TVM. Both PyTorch and MXNet is aligning towards TVM. And
wait, PyTorch? PyTorch aligning to TVM?
There is a fork.
Really?
Yeah, there is a fork of PyTorch with TVM integration. And it's also open source. So PyTorch has a integration with TVM and there is some alignment happening there. I'm not sure whether it will come to the mainstream. Probably there is another competing project within the PyTorch community. It's called Glow. So if you search for
Glow, that's, yes,
it's something like very similar to TVM that Facebook is developing to run, because they also have a lot of server load, mobile load, and there are so many other types of apps and various things that runs deep learning workloads, right? So there is a critical need for their business itself to be like really optimized and build this tool chain. So I don't see as a surprise if they are going to say, I am going to go full on Glow and build it natively in-house and make PyTorch just work with that really well. It will not be a surprise from their business need to make this happen customized for their use cases.
By the way, I think Glow, it's more to XLA. This is a compiler. It's not intermediary representation. Obviously, compiler by itself will have it some type of... Oh, I look in the Glow. They do have low-level IR
anything
that they're posting
you put
it.
Compiler will have starting point as IR.
Sure, yes, but my point is it looks like this is just a compiler. Like XLA and in TensorFlow as a compiler obviously would have intermediary representation for sure. Okay, interesting. I actually completely missed both of these news. I didn't know that PyTorch even looking towards TVM, and for sure, to tell the truth, I thought TVM is dead. Like, it looks like no, and I would be curious to see how it will progress from the PyTorch if they're actually going to move there or not.
By TVM core authors. It's called OctoML, if I'm not wrong. Is that right, Chaitanya? OctoML. It's OctoML, I guess. So there's a new company, and they also got 15 million seed funding last week. And they are the authors of TVM, University of Washington people. And so TVM is not dead. Very likely TVM will be acquired by Apple. I'm just making a wild guess here. But I've seen a trend where there is this Allen Institute of AI in the University of Washington, I guess. I might. Mm-hmm. And Apple has a history of acquiring AI startups built over there. Even recently, they acquired some company which was optimizing deep learning models specifically to run on low-powered devices, like as much as low as like a small cell, like plant wetness detector. So they optimize ML models to run on such small devices, which actually runs on solar-powered battery. So you could see the optimization level. So that company was acquired by Apple a few weeks ago. And there is a history of companies being acquired by Apple. Say Turi was also a Seattle-based startup. They were working on ML space, specifically for inference SDK and other things that got acquired by Apple. So I'm making a wild guess here. If people from OctoML are listening, or someone who is associated with that listening, they might be saying that even I haven't thought about it. This guy is making a prediction. So that will not be strange. Yes, I'm making a prediction, but I feel OctoML is in the right direction, and a lot of models needs to be optimized, and this compiler technology becomes critical for companies like Apple, Facebook, AWS, and others.
If somebody from OctoML or Apple is listening, then maybe this could be a self-fulfilling prediction.
Yeah.
What this reminds me, there was several... so we've been in the interesting work for quite a long, and there was several attempt to make a programming language that encapsulates cloud awareness and deploys to different cloud. Like one I do remember was around Python. If some of you folks remember the name of this initiative, when you're effectively writing Python, then it deploys on the cloud as a Lambda functions. Literally each function would be cloud function. I wonder if the current initiative to make ML deployable everywhere is the same. So I can see it's either Java and will be become super successful, or it's either this interesting movement that will lead us nowhere. I'm trying to figure out what the problem they solving, to be fair.
Dude, like deploying each function as a separate Lambda function, that sounds like such a scary level of microserviceness.
Yes, but I'm trying to figure out in which cases I will need to deploy my model to a different zoo of the hardware. I'm just trying to wrap my head around it to find the exact problem. I more or less understand optimization problem, and even in that space I wonder who can solve better optimization problem for NVIDIA's GPU except NVIDIA. Or for GPU hardware except Google. So then the problem might be to optimize for different hardware at the same time, where effectively you deploying on, let's say, NVIDIA, HTPU, and on your toaster. And all these three places have completely different hardware, so you don't want to learn NVIDIA's optimizations, TPU optimizations, and what your toaster can do, so you're going to this intermediary optimization layer that effectively communicates with NVIDIA for you. They already built a trust relationship with NVIDIA and they know how to optimize it for specifically NVIDIA's hardware. And they will do it for other stuff. I need to reflect more on this. I learned a lot. Thank you, Sandeep, for bringing this. Like, I learned a lot today. That is really good.
That's a very interesting topic. It will be like an episode of its own. So I don't want to get started, but it's a very interesting topic.
It is a fun topic, though. I think this might be a good point to end this episode.
Yeah, I just wanted to give out one line, like Chaitanya was suggesting, make your listeners think or respond. So I just wanted to say one line before I close off for this episode. First of all, I enjoyed a lot. We had our guests, so that was pretty fun and interesting. My last line of the day is like, think like there is already convergence on the front end of deep learning and machine learning technologies. And all of these things that we discussed and upcoming and optimizations, compiler, IR is all about the work happening in convergence or total divergence on the back end. So it's like two parts of the problem. Front end is fully converse. Everyone has very similar APIs now. They all believe, okay, this is the right thing to do. There is no differentiating factor. Now it's all about back end. So from here, either it can fully diverge or everything will converge like it happened in the front end.
Oh, by the way, front end, there was a very, very narrow-ish time frame in the human history when we had almost everyone conversion Chromium engine for front end, and everything went to south from there again. So yes, it's much better than the back end, I agree with you, but it's still far away, unless you mean something else about the conversions. Yeah, I would guess you're speaking about the technology, right?
Yeah, I'm talking about the design itself, design philosophy. How should the API design be in the front end?
Oh, yeah, okay, you're right, yeah, okay.
Well, on that note, everyone, thanks a lot for listening. And dude, Slava and Sandeep, this was a really cool talk, so I'll enjoy when these talks go in random directions, because that's when the real interesting learning happens.
That's not special for our podcast. Most of the time it does happen that way. And Chaitanya actually gave me a feedback when I talked about our podcast to him. He said, like, do you guys script? Because I think, like, you have not scripted your podcast. That was his statement. I was like, you're spot on. We are not scripting. And yes, we are successful because you got to know that we are not scripting. At least you got a doubt that we are not scripting it.
Yeah, and now it's verified.
Yes. Independent verification. Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot, everyone. Take care. We'll see you next time. And thanks a lot for joining us, Chai.